spacebar. Right. Got it. I just wanted to kick off with a little slide from Eurobarometer slide showing something on crime statistics, which Bernard didn't use. Crime statistics are a little bit below halfway down. Blue is the general European percentage in the Europe who regard these as particularly important issues. Yellow is the UK. The UK is worse than Europe in general. So I'd like to thank the Foundation for Science and Technology for inviting me to speak at this meeting. It is an auspicious day, the UN's inaugural World Statistics Day, so it's entirely appropriate that today's topic should be statistics. I sometimes describe statistics as providing a window to the world. By this I mean that statistics opens up and reveals to us structures, properties, characteristics and relationships which are otherwise concealed from us. Of course, the world is an awesomely complex place, and just as looking through a window doesn't tell us everything about the world outside, so statistics can't tell us everything about the world it describes. We have to decide what aspects upon which to focus our attention and from what angles we should peer. This question of perspective, angle, or viewpoint is critical. Different perspectives can reveal different things about the world. In fact, these perspectives can sometimes appear to be contradictory, so it's vital to recognise that they are distinct perspectives. Suppose I choose to characterise the size of the individuals in a population using their heights. Then I can explore how the average sizes of the individuals in populations change over time, how two populations compare, and so on. But I'm likely to draw very different conclusions if I ask the same question using weight as my measure of size. The issue is ubiquitous. For example, it applies to attempts to rank hospitals, schools, and universities. I can recall hovering between being amused and appalled by a university ranking scheme which included as an input variable the number of papers in Nature and Science, and consequently gave a very low rank to the London School of Economics. Bernard Silverman's outline of crime statistics illustrated perfectly this potential for confusion if multiple, rather different, definitions of crime are used. A specific illustration of it is credit card fraud. Bernard referred to this. My research group at Imperial recently finished a multi-year, multi-bank project aimed at constructing improved methods of credit card fraud detection. So when you get a phone call from your bank saying, "Did you make this transaction?" I'm sorry, it's probably my fault. Now, if Bernard's talk has convinced you of the difficulty of defining crime in general, let me tell you that defining fraud is twice as tough. At a very superficial level, you have to decide whether you will include just the immediate loss due to the fraud. Or should you also include the cost of fraud prevention and detection? And what about the cost of lost business due to the card being destroyed? And the opportunity cost of prevention and detection? And the deterrent effect on the spread of e-commerce and so on? And here's another little example. If I go out and have a spending splurge and spend far more than I expected to, and I come home and I think, how am I going to explain this to my wife? Then I have a brilliant idea. I know what I'll do. I'll declare that someone had stolen my card. I'll claim that someone had stolen my card. It wasn't fraud when I made the transactions. It only became fraud when I decided to do that. So the pattern is exactly the same. All that's changed is the class definition, simply by virtue of me changing my mind. So a lot of subtleties. It's this sort of thing, allied to the basic difficulty of detecting something which the perpetrators are trying to conceal, which explains why estimates of the annual cost of fraud to the UK range from £7 billion to £70 billion per annum, an order of magnitude difference. We can also see from Bernard's examples that the choice can have real practical consequences. It's all very well for an academic to say, well, on the one hand, if you measure it this way, then X follows, but if you measure it that way, then Y follows. Government doesn't have the luxury of sitting on the fence since it has to implement policy to take actions. It has to make a choice. The topical example of the choice between RPI and CPI in different circumstances. The key message from all of these examples is that different measures measure different things. And it follows that unless one has a highly specific aim in mind, it's probably dangerous to rely on a single summary statistic. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the parable of the elephant and the blind men, each of whom had an entirely different notion of what an elephant was on the basis of their limited perspective. It's certainly true that focusing exclusively on a single perspective leads down the slope of Goodhart's law, which states that any observed statistical regularity will tend to collapse once pressure is placed on it for control purposes. It also means that other non-targeted aspects of performance may deteriorate to unacceptable levels. Recall the classic example of the nail factory, which met its target of weight of nails by producing a single gigantic nail. Focusing on a single perspective can often lead to ignoring other equally important aspects of performance. The inevitable conclusion is that we should embrace the use of multiple perspectives, of multiple statistical summary measures, recognising their distinctness and revelling in their diversity. The UKSA report, Overcoming Barriers to Trust in Crime Statistics, first says, having two different sources can undoubtedly cause confusion. But then it goes on to say, but the answer is not to change either of them fundamentally. The two sets of statistics throw different lights on the incident and experience of crime, and we need both of them. The confusion arising from multiple measures can be alleviated, if not removed, by using different names for the different measures. We do this for money supply, and of course we do it for inflation measures. We can see the advantage of this. People don't confuse RPI and CPI, but we can also see from that example that it doesn't completely solve the problem. In particular, it doesn't resolve the issue of which of the various measures is appropriate for which question. But moving from the position that statisticians don't know what they're talking about to the position that different measures measure different things is a great leap indeed. It's a leap from blind criticism beyond blind acceptance to critical assessment. And it's exactly this leap that the Royal Statistical Society's 10-year statistical literacy campaign, Get Stats, to which Sir Michael referred, is striving to promote. As many of you will know, a 2007 Eurobarometer survey, which I've got up here, which I'm sure most of you have seen, another Eurobarometer survey, which showed that public confidence in statistics in the UK was lowest in Europe, 2007. Unfortunately, a 2009 survey showed that things hadn't improved, with only 33% agreeing that official statistics were accurate. We clearly have a long way to go, but unfortunately, I don't think I can add that we've already come a long way. Recall Sir Josiah Stamp writing in 1929, the government are very keen on amassing statistics. They collect them, add them, raise them to the nth power, take the cube root and prepare wonderful diagrams. But you must never forget that every one of those figures comes in the first instance from the village watchman who just put down what he damn well pleases. So that's the position of blind criticism, of unthinking suspicion. It's clearly an extreme suspicion, position and an unhelpful position. But what about the other extreme? The UKSA report, Overcoming Barriers to Trust in Crime Statistics, included the following comments. It's the job of the professional statistician in government to filter the signal from the noise and explain the results in a way that is trusted. But I want to ask, is that quite right? Bernard Madoff explained his investment results in a way that was trusted. Didn't mean that they should have been trusted or that they shouldn't have been subjected to rigorous examination. We don't want to swing through 180 degrees from Josiah Stamp's mistrust to uncritical accepting trust. Blind, unthinking, uncritical trust leads to its own problems. What we really need to promote is critical assessment of statistics in general. Sir Michael pointed out a moment ago that we needed to give people more reason to have trust and confidence in official statistics through understanding and knowledge. And that's the key. We need to enable people to recognise the building blocks and to have elementary building expertise so that they can see that the statistical structures are sound. Richard Aldrich has commented that there are lots of untrustworthy statistics. We want people to trust statisticians to explain statistics rather than promote uncritical acceptance. Critical assessment would include an evaluation of the source from which the statistics arose. In the present context, one might hope that the public would grow to recognise and appreciate the painstaking rigour that goes into the collection of government statistics by official statisticians. And one might hope that the public would be able to contrast this with the bizarre lack of rigour that goes into such things as Man of the Year polls. One might also hope that the public would appreciate the absurdity of university league tables based on student surveys in which the respondents are self-selected. So So I've shifted the emphasis from trust to critical assessment, with the latter being a precursor to the former in those cases where the inference is justified. But that's only one interpretation of trust. One can mistrust statistics because one doubts their accuracy, but one can also mistrust the intended use to which statistical descriptions will be put. This conspiracy theory of government statistics is also one which needs to be tackled by education, by helping people to understand the uses to which the statistics will be put and the benefits which will derive from them. The role of media in all of this is critical. The Royal Statistical Society organises one-day meetings for journalists in which leading statisticians present important and topical statistical ideas in an unthreatening manner. We're clearly succeeding, as these meetings are extremely popular, with delegates coming back for more. However, we can only scrape the surface. There are more journalists out there than we can possibly reach, and not all of them will have the courage to step through the Society's doors. I think it's also inevitable, in the nature of at least some media outlets, that they will always want simple, snap answers. I'll come back to that in a moment, but perhaps what's needed is also a wider recognition that sometimes, rather than bending the truth to permit a pseudo-answer which is readily comprehensible without effort, it's necessary to make the effort to understand the unbent truth. I'm reminded of one variant of Murphy's Law, which says that complex problems have simple, easy to understand, wrong answers. When I gave my presidential address to the Royal Statistical Society, I remarked that statistics was widely misunderstood. I noted that to many statisticians who use their skills and tools to dig deep into data, gaining insights and understanding, and unearthing previously undiscovered and possibly unsuspected knowledge, this was rather puzzling. How could such a modern voyage of discovery be anything but incredibly exciting? And I think the answer lies in several areas. One is the lack of trust that I've already discussed. Another, and this was also referred to by Sir Michael, is innumeracy and number phobia. Excuse me. I hope that the immensely exciting dynamic graphics, which are becoming increasingly widely used, will blow away that particular fog of incomprehension. And if I can be permitted a small trailer here, keep your eyes open for a BBC4 television programme entitled The Joy of Statistics, which is to be broadcast before the end of the year. It's truly wonderful. A third reason is surely a failure to recognise that statistical summaries are measurements of some aspect of a population and should be expected to change as time elapses or as further data become available. If a statistical estimate is later updated as more data become available, it's not a mark of poor initial analysis, but of an increasingly refined measurement procedure. Remember Keynes' comment, "When the facts change, I change my mind." And don't forget his sequel, "What do you do, sir?" Freakonomics, even though they're really describing the use of statistics. Perhaps it's a case of people adopting the advice given to Stephen Hawking when he wrote A Brief History of Time, and supposing that every use of the word statistics will halve your readership. One might have thought that, given what we've experienced over the last couple of years, every use of the word economics would quarter your readership. And this morning, at the absurdly early hour of 6:20 a.m., I received further insight into public misunderstanding of statistics. The ITV Daybreak programme had learnt that it was World Statistics Day and had decided to do a short piece on it. Short is the apposite word, since it was a two-minute slot, squeezed between a piece on embarrassing incidents which had happened to celebrities and a piece on two endearing half-breed wolves. I'm afraid statistics doesn't really compete with pets in the eye of the British public. The statistics piece opened with some background material, including the statistic that one in five British women have gone to work without wearing underwear, and that the great British public steal 430,000 gallons of shampoo from hotels each year. You can see what I was up against. But what really brought the misconceptions home to me was when the interviewer asked me for some fascinating statistics. You know, it's a sort of, what's your favourite number? I toyed with telling her that the average woman in England and Wales had 1.96 children, and going into an explanation of what that meant, since I've certainly never met a woman with 1.96 children. But I decided that was too complicated. Instead, I said that half of all the scientists who'd ever lived was still alive now. And I have to say that the hunted look which appeared in her eyes showed me what we were up against. You could see her thinking, what does this mean? Why is he telling me this? Am I supposed to laugh or gasp? They ended the piece with another fascinating statistic they'd found, that the British eat twice as many baked beans per head as other Europeans. Wonderful thing, statistics. As I said at the start, statistics provide a window to the world. Without the views provided by statistics, we could neither create nor monitor housing policies. We would not know where were the greatest needs, nor where to locate a new retail outlet, nor how our local schools or hospitals were doing, nor how to adapt our transport policies. And neither would we know whether crime was increasing or decreasing. Coming back to crime also brings me back to the need for critical assessment. Without an awareness of the complexities and the assumptions on which the different measures are based, no rational conversation is possible. And without such an awareness, the cloth is all too easily pulled over our eyes. Think of the efforts to conceal and confuse the impact of climate change, leaded petrol, and cigarette smoking, to name just three areas. I've used the confusion over crime statistics described so lucidly by Bernard as a launchpad for a more general discussion of official statistics and the public's perception of official statistics. But there's another aspect which I feel I should at least mention, and which neither of the two previous speakers may have felt able to mention. This is that the public includes our politicians. During my presidency of the Royal Statistical Society, I've engaged with representatives of both the previous and the present administration. For example, raising such things as the importance of the census. Not everyone appreciates the multiple use to which census data are put, nor that, for example, the census data will be used to guide the distribution of £1 trillion of public money, perhaps slightly less today, I suppose, to local authorities over the next 10 years at a cost of less than one-half of one-tenth of 1% of that amount. That sort of efficiency ratio is one which most commercial organisations would be proud to achieve. Other issues we've discussed include the importance of a national address list, pre-release access, and today's hot topic, how vital it is that the view from the window of statistics is not clouded by uncoordinated cuts in statistical measurement across different departments. There can be few issues which span government departments in the way that statistics does, so a piecemeal approach to cuts courts disaster. It's just as important, one might argue far more important, that our politicians understand the view that they see from the window of statistics as it is that the wider public understands the view. Anyone who is not educated in statistical understanding is using a window with the blinds still drawn. In 1938, H.G. Wells wrote, "A certain elementary training in statistical methods is becoming as necessary for anyone living in this world of today as reading and writing." Our Get Stats campaign is aiming to promote that necessary elementary understanding. It would be nice if we could achieve it into the 21st century. Thank you.